This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting today from San Francisco, California. This will be the first of two podcasts on patients who have residual or recurrent Cushing's disease after surgery. As most of you know, Cushing's disease is the term used to refer to patients who have a pituitary adenoma that secretes ACTH and overdrives the adrenal glands to reduce cortisol, resulting in the clinical syndrome that we refer to as Cushing's syndrome. Pituitary adenomas come in basically two types, or at least the way we think of it clinically, and those are patients who have microadenomas that are less than 1 centimeter in size and macroadenomas greater than 1 centimeter in size. A small number of patients have pituitary cancers, or what we call giant adenomas greater than 4 centimeter, and then an even smaller proportion of patients will have what we call pituitary hyperplasia. It's probably driven by CRH production, leading to pituitary-dependent Cushing's, if you will. So what's the magnitude of this problem? Well, we know that in the best hands, probably 90 to 95% of patients with microadenomas will be rendered disease-free by surgery. When it comes to macroadenomas, the best hands, maybe two-thirds will enter remission after surgery, with remission rates depending on the size of the tumor, the invasiveness of the tumor, and obviously the surgical skill of the surgeon doing the operation. In regards to recurrences, roughly 5 to 10% of those with microadenomas will have a recurrence, and anywhere from 30 to 50% of those with macroadenomas will suffer from a recurrence at some point. Recurrence is an ever-present threat. Most recurrences will occur in the first 2 to 5 years, but I've seen a patient as late as 14 years out from initial surgery develop recurrent hypercortisolism related to a pituitary adenoma. My personal feeling is that those patients who have recurrent disease are surgical failures because there were probably a small number of cells left behind by the surgeon. Maybe they couldn't see them, and certainly sometimes they're not seen on MRI. But over time, after surgery, those cells will proliferate and grow new blood vessels and become a recurrent tumor that at first might produce low levels of ACTH and drive normal levels of cortisol, so the patient will look like they have normal cortisol levels, but there'll be a loss of diurnal variation because cortisol will be secreted around the clock instead of during the normal circadian variation that most of us will have. So that over time, ultimately there's enough cells to produce enough ACTH to cause hypercortisolism and recurrent Cushingoid symptoms and signs. So once again, I consider those patients who have recurrent disease after an initial period of remission to be surgical failures who had residual disease to begin with. So how do we identify those patients who have either residual or recurrent disease? This is a subject of intense scrutiny in that there's been a lot of research in the area, and also of much debate because most endocrinologists will differ on the best approach to take to try to identify those patients who need additional treatment. For example, some physicians advocate looking at serum cortisol levels about 2 days after surgery, whereas others, including myself, believe that the cortisol levels 6 to 12 weeks after surgery are probably the better predictors of long-term outcome. And I believe this to be the case because I read a study years ago, and certainly in keeping with my clinical experience, that even some patients with, quote, normal, unquote, cortisol levels after surgery, only about a quarter of those will go on to have recurrent hypercortisolism. And in those patients who have undetectable levels of cortisol after surgery, about 8% will later go on to have a recurrence. So I think those early levels are probably not as good as the 6 to 12 week levels. But the first decision a surgeon or endocrinologist has to make after surgery is, does the patient require steroids? And that's because if you've had successful removal of your ACTH-producing pituitary tumor, you no longer have a source of ACTH production. Your adrenal glands are going to stop producing cortisol, and you'll have adrenal insufficiency of a central nature. And that's because the normal ACTH-producing cells left behind in the pituitary gland have been suppressed, and it can take them generally 8 to 10, 12, or even 24 months to recover from that suppression, depending on the extent of or magnitude of hypercortisolism and the duration of the disease process. Generally, in my practice, if your cortisol level is 7 or less, you're going to go home on steroids. If it's higher than 7, we may do further testing within the first couple of weeks to determine whether you need steroids. Definitely, if it's under 2, where we like to see it, you need steroid treatment. Patients who have elevated cortisol levels, we tend not to send home on steroids, presuming that we didn't remove all of their tumor. Or if we know there is tumor left behind after the operation based on the surgeon's findings, we tend to not send those patients home on steroids either. In general, we're holding steroid supplementation, or if the patient didn't go home on steroids, we're looking at serum cortisol level 6 and 12 weeks out. If you have a normal or an elevated cortisol, we're reevaluating the 24-hour urine cortisol. Those who have normal cortisol levels, we would typically then proceed with a salivary cortisol profile, checking 3 saliva samples in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, and 3 at the end of the day to see if there is indeed loss of diurnal variation confirming tumoral ACTH production driving cortisol production by the adrenal glands. Those patients who have residual disease after surgery are easy. We can figure those out because their cortisol levels are either normal or elevated. Their urine cortisols might be elevated. They have a loss of diurnal variation of cortisol secretion. The ones that are more difficult to track and follow are those patients who have had resection of most of their tumor. Maybe their microscopic cells left behind. They have postoperative adrenal insufficiency. They require steroids. And then at some point in time, they will come off steroids, either because they are normal or because their residual disease is progressing such that they're now having, quote, normal, unquote, cortisol levels and no longer need steroids. Those patients whose pituitary glands are simply recovering from the suppression will basically have a reset to normal. Their cortisol levels will come up, they'll be normal, they'll come off steroid levels or steroid therapy, and we will find that their cortisol levels stay normal. If we did a salivary cortisol profile, they will have a normal diurnal variation of cortisol secretion. Those patients with residual or recurrent, if you will, Cushing's disease will have an abnormal diurnal variation. Their cortisol levels may be normal for a while, but over time, their cortisol levels will just keep rising and they'll ultimately become elevated. My goal is to try to detect these patients before they become hypercortisolemic and suffer the ravages of the disease. And interestingly, many patients, even though they have high normal cortisol levels, will tell you, my Cushing's is back, I'm gaining weight, I can't sleep. And that's where the salivary cortisol profile in the setting of normal ACTH cortisol and urine cortisol levels can be helpful, because it'll show you that the diurnal variation is abnormal in those patients. So we can detect those people having early recurrence very soon by looking at that salivary cortisol profile. Again, my goal is to catch it before patients have recurrent hypercortisolism and suffer the ravages of the disease. But unfortunately, a number of patients live a distance from my practice and they're followed by local primary physicians or endocrinologists, and they're hypercortisolemic by the time they get back to us. But at least they find their way back and we can proceed with additional evaluation and management. Just as in making the diagnosis up front, patients who have had surgery have to undergo a lot of tests sometimes before we can make judgment about whether or not their disease has been put into remission or whether they have recurrent disease. Well, let me share with you some of the reasons that surgery might fail in the first place. The most important and obvious, that really shouldn't bear mentioning, but it's worth mentioning, is that there was incomplete or failed tumor resection. And this can happen because many of these tumors are invasive. The macroadenomas are more likely to be invasive than the microadenomas. But even the microadenomas, even though they look well circumscribed on MRI, can be invasive. In fact, studies have showed where physicians have removed a tumor and gone in and biopsied the walls of the hole where the tumor came out, that 62% of macroadenomas are invasive into their surrounding tissues, whether it be the dura mater, bone or the floor of the cellar or even the normal pituitary gland. And 8% of microadenomas are microscopically invasive into the surrounding tissues, though the surgeon thought the tumor was entirely resected. So it's frequent that there are cells left behind. And frankly, I'm not surprised, given the recurrence rate, where we have patients with a microadenoma, all the tumors removed, and 3 years later they have recurrent disease. So some of these tumor cells are very fastidious, and they can divide and grow new blood vessels and form recurrent tumors. On the other hand, I'm surprised that we don't see more recurrences than we do, especially with these microscopic invasive rates. Now, another reason the person might have failure of surgery is that a tumor was not identified at surgery. And we know that in one study, for example, the failure rate when a tumor was seen on MRI was 13%, but if the surgeon was operating with a negative MRI, the failure rate was 26%. That's an important figure because a number of these ACTH-producing tumors are actually quite small. Probably some of them are 2 to 4 millimeters in size, and the surgeon gets in, dissects out the pituitary, looking for the tumor, or through the pituitary, I should say, and may or may not find a tumor. And we certainly have sent patients to surgery, couldn't find the tumor, and the failure rate is higher in that setting, whereas if we identify a tumor either on MRI or at the time of surgery. When you look at histopathology, if the histopathology is negative, in one study the failure rate was 17% if a tumor was identified, but 47% if no tumor was identified. You might ask, well, who's going to surgery if they don't have a tumor on MRI? Well, we know that a number of these tumors are microscopic, and we base our decisions to operate on clinical symptoms and signs and biochemical tests and hopefully confirmatory inferior petrosal sinus sampling that suggests a pituitary source of ACTH secretion. I will say, however, some of these patients have corticotroph hyperplasia. Sometimes there's a pituitary tumor that's ectopically located in the cavernous sinus or in the suprasellar region or along the pituitary stalk. And unfortunately, still in this day and age, some patients have the syndrome of ectopic ACTH hypersecretion with a tumor located elsewhere, but a surgeon takes them to surgery thinking the tumor is probably in the pituitary gland. And that's where the inferior petrosal sinus sampling is an essential test in those patients who have Cushing's but a negative MRI. They should all undergo inferior petrosal sinus sampling unless there's convincing results of dynamic tests suggesting that there is definitely a pituitary adenoma. And lastly, one other potential explanation for negative pathology not being rendered disease-free is that the patient didn't have Cushing syndrome in the first place. And that setting would be pseudo-Cushing syndrome due to depression, anxiety, alcoholism, erroneous diagnosis of a patient who has metabolic syndrome thought to have hypercortisolism. And then in my practice, I've seen two cases of factitious Cushing's of patients who were taking actually steroids used in veterinary practices causing hypercortisolism and were thought to have pituitary adenomas with periodic hormonogenesis or cyclical Cushing's. And indeed, it was a factitious Cushing's patient in one case, and in another one, the patient was actually surreptitiously receiving steroids in the form of a skin cream meant to replace female hormones and was referred, thought to have a pituitary adenoma, but turned out to be, I should say, surreptitious Cushing's rather than factitious in that particular setting. So as you can imagine, if a patient has residual or recurrent hypercortisolism, the physician and the patient have their work cut out for them. The patient has to submit to tests. The physician has to take a logical approach to the evaluation and management of the patient and decision-making regarding laboratory and radiologic data, surgical findings, etc. This is clearly an arena where a logical and systematic stepwise approach best serves the patient who has recurrent or residual disease. And my first approach is to confirm the presence of pathologic ACTH and cortisol hypersecretion. So if you think the patient has recurrent disease, or especially those with residual, evaluate it. Is the ACTH secretion pathologic, meaning does it have the pattern of tumoral ACTH secretion, or did the patient really have normal ACTH secretion and maybe cortisol levels related to stress and didn't have Cushing's to begin with? And the way to do that is to proceed with some of the diagnostic testing that I discussed earlier. The next step is to confirm the preoperative diagnosis of ACTH-dependent hypercortisolism, and that requires a very careful review of all the laboratory results and radiological results to determine, did this patient really truly have hypercortisolism, and was it dependent on ACTH secretion? So these first two steps are critical. They're basically saying, was the diagnosis correct to begin with, or was an error in judgment and decision making? And is the diagnosis correct now? So does the patient have the disease now? Those are very important steps. And frankly, I think they're best done by an endocrinologist, and sometimes not the same physician who evaluated and managed the patient prior to surgery, so that you can have a fresh, unbiased approach. So the third step, if you will, would be to review the histopathology. Was there an ACTH immunopositive lesion seen? If so, then the patient probably still has residual tumor, especially if they have not entered remission after surgery, or they have recurrent tumor regrowth from residual cells if they have recurrent disease years after surgery. So that pathology report is essential. And knowing whether it was ACTH immunopositive is essential as well. And I mention that because not all hospitals have immunochemistry abilities to evaluate pituitary adenomas. So, for example, some small hospitals will see a patient with Cushing's, the surgeon will take the tumor out, and the pathologist says there was a pituitary adenoma, but it doesn't tell you anything about whether it secreted ACTH because they didn't do the tests. And occasionally we have to do immunostaining on tumors that we get the slides from outside hospitals, so it's essential to have that confirmatory ACTH immunopositive lesion on the scan. In the patients where there's no tumor, we wonder, was the tumor left behind or was there a tumor there at all? One helpful finding is to look for what's called Crookes Hyaline change, and this is hyalinization with eosinophilia of the cellular area around the nucleus within the cells, and this Crookes Hyaline change is always seen when there's been hypercortisolism. If you don't see that on the scan, the patient probably did not have Cushing's and may have had pseudo-Cushing's, and it's essentially a pathognomonic finding. You always see it. And this is a hyalinization that is seen usually in the non-tumoral ACTH-producing cells. So the fragments of normal pituitary that often accompany a pituitary adenoma at the time of surgery, you would look for Crookes Hyaline change in the ACTH immunopositive cells in normal pituitary. One caveat here is that some, and rare, ACTH-producing tumors are actually Crookes cell adenomas, where the pituitary tumor cells themselves have the Crookes Hyaline change. That's not something we usually see with ACTH-producing pituitary tumors, but there is that rare subset of tumors that have Crookes Hyaline change. But we look for Crookes Hyaline change in normal pituitary. If you don't see it, the diagnosis was wrong and the patient didn't have Cushing's to begin with. And we actually encounter that and see that on occasional patients referred to us for evaluation having had surgery elsewhere. So it's an important part of the evaluation of the so-called surgical failure. Then the last step in the evaluation of the surgical failure is to consider the differential diagnosis. So if a tumor is present, clearly that's the answer, that there's residual disease. But if there was no tumor present on MRI, seen at surgery, or on pathology, then one has to step back, especially if you're confident that the patient had ACTH-dependent Cushing's. You proceed with inferior petrosal sinus sampling to exclude ectopic ACTH. If it looks like it's a central source, you can get additional MRI studies looking for a pituitary stalk adenoma or a tumor in the cavernous sinuses. If the patient has ectopic ACTH based on these studies, you can do an octreotide scan and other biochemical tests looking for the cause of the ectopic ACTH-producing tumor. Before I conclude, let me say just a couple things about some of these tests. First, inferior petrosal sinus sampling. That should be performed by experienced surgeons and should be done with CRH administration. So if you find yourself facing that test, ensure that the team doing the test is composed of a skilled interventional neuroradiologist and that they will use CRH. When it comes to MRI, we prefer the 3 Tesla magnets, and I think everybody with Cushing's, especially if they have residual disease, recurrent disease, or a, quote, normal, unquote, pituitary MRI prior to surgery, they should have gadolinium contrast, and it should be dynamic contrast enhanced scans, because your simple pre- and post-contrast scans will miss some of those small tumors. So really the dynamic studies are the key, whether you're looking at preoperative or postoperative images in those patients who have either normal MRIs prior to surgery or negative pathology and no tumor found at surgery. The dynamic studies can help you find tumors that you can't see otherwise. And lastly, it's important to always, from the time of suspicion of the disease process all the way through treatment, to not put the cart before the horse. My mentor at Hopkins, Dr. Gary Wand, used to talk about how errors in judgment in patients with hypercortisolism were very costly, so that it was important to proceed in a stepwise and logical fashion. And I would remind you that starts with a clinical suspicion, confirmatory biochemical tests, and then the radiological tests, and then the treatment. And whether you're a new patient with Cushing's or a patient with residual or recurrent disease, this process takes time and has to evolve in a stepwise fashion so that we minimize the errors in judgment that lead to treatment choices. This is particularly important in the realm of pituitary disorders because treatment has its adverse effects, side effects, and negative outcomes, just as does the primary disease process. Well, that's all for today. In the subsequent podcast, I'll talk about a recommended approach to the management of patients with residual and recurrent Cushing's disease. We'll address repeat surgery, radiotherapy, and medical therapy. And then in subsequent podcasts, I'll review the different agents that can be used to treat hypercortisolism in patients with Cushing's syndrome and Cushing's disease. The music used in this podcast is D sharp G by the lovely Sharon Van Etten. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins. You've listened to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Thank you for your time and your attention. As always, feel free to write us with suggestions for potential future topics and any questions you may have. Have a good day.